ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Have you ever wondered why everyone's worried about microplastics?
Or what the best time of day is to exercise?
And why are some people left-handed, Tegan?
Well, the best people are. Anyway, we've got the show for you. It's called What's That Rash?
Where we answer the health questions everyone's asking. I'm physician and journalist Dr. Norman Swan.
And I'm health reporter Tegan Taylor.
And we promise we're not here to sell you supplements.
It is surprisingly hard to find podcast hosts who aren't.
But we do want you to search for What's That Rash in the ABC Listen app.
And we might answer your question next.
In the Daily Telegraph of Sydney, 23rd of January 1953, severed head of snake kills woman, which, sorry, I've got to compose myself here.
So the headline is, severed head of snake kills woman.
To me, like straight away, I was like, oh, okay, that's already interesting.
That's Ray Miller from Townsville.
And
he was checking out a branch of his family tree when he...
Yeah, come across, I think it was my great-great-aunt who had a bit of an interesting... story in the newspaper. The severed head of a snake this week killed a 72-year-old woman and a dog.
His great-great-aunt and his great-great-dog. Dead. Oh, that is one hell of a lead. On ABC Radio National, welcome to What the Duck, where I, Dr. Anne Jones, run down rabbit holes in search of the stranger side of nature, and sometimes the most dangerous sides of nature. Australia is famous for its formidable collection of lethal creatures, bitey spiders, chompy crocs, even a kick from a cassowary can kill.
Crikey!
But are they a danger to human society, even after they've kicked the bucket? What the Duck reporter Belinda Smith is along today to tell me about post-mortality mortalities.
Do you have the article handy by any chance?
Yeah.
Can you just read it out for me, please?
The severed head of a snake this week killed a 72-year-old woman and a dog. The woman was Mrs. Annie Elizabeth Whitby of Millbrook near Gunnedah. So that's where my grandparents were from. So that's helped me verify this is a relation to my grandmother.
This is Ray Miller from Townsville again.
On Tuesday, Mrs. Whitby's husband saw a large brown snake at the back of their house. He shot the snake with a shotgun, severing the head from the body. The Whitby's dog picked up the head with a... Oh, sorry. I'm going to hell for this. The Whitby's dog picked up the head with a portion of the body attached and ran around the yard with it in its mouth. Mrs. Whitby caught the dog and took the snake's head from its mouth. As she did so, the head, quote-unquote, bit her. Mr. Whitby took her and the dog to Gunnedah doctors immediately. Doctors immediately treated Mrs. Whitby, but she died about 9 hours later in Gunnedah District Hospital. And then it's just it's paragraph and single line. The dog also died.
So snake venom isn't just one thing. It depends on the species in terms of the composition of the venom. Think about venom as a complex cocktail.
I love a fancy drink. What's on the menu?
We largely try to categorize this into neurotoxic, hemotoxic, and cytotoxic effects.
Like?
Drooping eyelids and asphyxiation, bleeding out internally, multiple organ failure, cerebral hemorrhage, bursting open cells, possibly lose a limb, kidney failure, which then can lead to death. To death. Death? To death.
That bringer of nightmares is Dr. Christina Zdenek, biologist and snake expert at the University of Queensland. The newspaper article with Ray's great-great-aunt and his great-great-granddog also mentions that there was a Victorian man who was bitten on the chest by a severed snake head in the 1950s. You can imagine how that went down. He survived, and more recently...
In 1977, in Alice Springs, a woman who went to a neighbour's place and saw a dog about to sniff the head of a decapitated snake. And so she went to go grab the neck of it, which was about 5 centimetres, according to the story. And as soon as she did, the head shot around and it got her with one fang puncture and then a scrape. And she was envenomated because she needed antivenom.
Yeah, wow.
So that's one story that I read about.
Oh, that's horrific. The thought of the snake bending around to bite her like that. Oh.
Yeah, for my part, I'm actually impressed she knew where the snake's neck was.
And for centuries, we humans have been aware that snakes do seem to live on after death. Back in the 14th century, an Egyptian zoologist by the name of Al-Damiri wrote that a dead viper's body will continue to wriggle for 3 days.
That is all we need, zombie snakes.
There's also the old saying that a snake won't die until the sun sets.
Mr. Kinghorn said the story that a snake would not die until sundown was an old wives' tale. Thanks, Mr. Science.
So, just how long after death can a snake survive? Well, we have some idea, thanks to an American herpetologist named Lawrence Klauber. Around a century ago, back before animal ethics were a thing, he ran a fairly gruesome experiment. Dr. Christina Zdenek.
And so it was based in America, and it was off of 13 rattlesnakes that they decapitated the heads of.
Holy moly.
In order to find out how long after the head had been removed that it can still do whatever behaviours. And one head bit a stick and discharged venom 43 minutes after decapitation.
43 minutes? So how the f*** can a dead snake, one with its head separated from its body for the average length of time it takes to play a Grand Slam tournament tennis set, how can that bite and pump venom into a stick or hand? It comes down to the fact that snakes are super efficient units.
A snake at rest might only breathe 5 times a minute, so already they have really low oxygen requirements, and they're just such an efficient animal. And so, you know, it's unsurprising to me that they can still have these like twitches, this post-mortem reflexes for quite a long period.
And if a dead snake sinks its fangs into your skin, you might end up copping a bigger dose of venom than if it was alive. So live snakes,
sometimes they do just give what's called a dry bite, where they will bite but choose not to envenomate. If you've got a decapitated head, the animal's technically dead, so you don't have consciousness or like choice or thought. It's like this reflexive reaction. And so in that scenario, I would imagine a full envenomation if both fangs did puncture the skin.
That snake decapitating scientist, Lawrence Klauber, he reckoned the only safe rule was to stay away from the head until the snake began to stiffen in rigor mortis. But
even one that's been dead for years.
Years!
That's another point too, is that there can be some residual neurotoxins on the fangs themselves, because these are really like persistent and I guess hardy toxins. You know, they don't degrade or denature rapidly. It's really like bacterial growth that really eventually might make them destabilize and, you know, take away their ability to do harm. But, you know, there could absolutely be some neurotoxins left and crystallized on the fangs.
So, you know, when you see online people have taxidermied their own snakes, maybe don't buy a taxidermied brown snake.
Just stay away from the fangs, you know, don't let that puncture you.
It's like the ultimate revenge, right? Exacting vengeance from beyond the grave. In a letter written to the New England Journal of Medicine in 1999, a couple of doctors in Arizona wrote about 5 cases of rattlesnake retribution, where the snakes, which had been bludgeoned or shot, bit the men who attacked them. They found there seems to be a type when it comes to these accidental snake envenomations: young, drunk, and male. Regardless of who you are or your state of inebriation, don't go killing snakes. They're handy when they're alive, keeping rats and other pests down.
And it is illegal in Australia.
And, you know, don't go out the back of a pub when you're drunk and grab a dead snake and pretend like it's biting you.
Or pick up a jellyfish on the beach and fling it at someone. Because sure, snakes can be scary creatures, and so can box jellyfish. They're our most deadly jellies. They've killed dozens of people, but they're only dangerous when they're alive, blobbing around in the ocean, right?
I think all jellyfish have the potential to sting long after the actual animal is dead.
Oh, good. Thanks for that disturbing fact, Professor Kylie Pitt, leader of the Griffith Sea Jellies Research Laboratory.
I've heard stories from commercial fishers that I've worked with that they'll put away their nets at the end of one fishing season and they'll bring their nets out at the start of the next fishing season, and as soon as they're wet, they start to get little pings of jellyfish stings happening. So this is months after the jellyfish have been, you know, well clear of the net.
Months? Oh. All right. So we've not found any reports of people dying by the hand or tentacle of a dead jellyfish, but they can inflict real damage. Back in 2010, a massive lion's mane jellyfish broke up at a New Hampshire beach. According to a New York Times report, it
turned the tranquil beach into a frenzied sea of screaming children and aching adults with red, sore feet and legs.
Love it.
In the end, the jellyfish's tentacles stung around 150 people and sent five kids to hospital. And that's because jellyfish tentacles sport thousands of tiny, specialised stinging cells. Each cell contains a tiny harpoon that, when touched, shoots out and, bam, injects venom.
And the touch is really interesting because each of the stinging cells has this tiny little operculum, or little trapdoor, if you like, that's got a hair trigger associated with it. So it's when that hair trigger is discharged that the operculum will burst open and the little tubule, which is the sting, will actually be injected, and that will inject the venom, which will cause the pain. They're amazing little structures, great little piece of engineering.
They're hardy little buggers too. It goes without saying that, you know, if you drape yourself in the tentacles of a freshly dead, still wet box jellyfish, all those trapdoor triggers will be set off and you won't have a fun time.
So, yeah, you definitely want to be careful when you're handling any jellies that have been washed up on the beach, because it is quite possible that the stinging cells will still activate.
But if jellyfish stinging cells dry out and fall off the tentacles,
they'll just remain as little specks of dust effectively. And as soon as they get hit by water, they'll take up the water and then they'll start reacting like a normal cell will react. So when they touch something, the stinging cells are going to fire.
Jellyfish stinging dust. Just add water.
This is such a good plot point for an evil storyline, Belle. Imagine gifting someone you really don't like at work a jellyfish bath bomb.
I both love this idea and find it abhorrent. A surfer in Broome found this out the painful way in 2022 when he got stung by a box jellyfish bad enough to send him to hospital. 5 weeks later, he decided to go for another surf, so he put on his wetsuit, but the jellyfish tentacles were still inside. They dried out, but when he hit the water, they reactivated and stung him again.
Stung from beyond the watery grave.
Ooh, ouch, 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 ouch.
The skin on our feet and on our hands is actually really quite thick. And so quite often you could handle these jellyfish and you wouldn't actually feel any response because the skin is so thick that the stinging cells can't penetrate it fully. And then you can actually transfer them to other parts of your body which are a lot more sensitive, so like inside of your arms or your lips. So a classic when I've been in the field and I've been, you know, I usually wear gloves when I'm handling the jellies, but inevitably if you've been around them, you end up with stinging cells on your hand. And so then, you know, when we go and we reapply sunscreen partway through the day, you get all these little pings happening over your face as you're transferring the stinging cells from your hands where you can't feel them to your face, which is a lot more sensitive.
Oh, I'm just thinking about like taking your contact lenses out at nighttime. Oh.
Oh my God, Belle. What already dead but still deadly creature could actually possibly be left?
Warning.
Generally, it's a problem that no one wants to have.
That's Dr. Olaf Meinecke.
I am the manager and researcher with the Whales and Climate Program at Griffith University.
Whales?
But this program's not about live whales.
Yes, I do have an interest in dead whales. Of course, I like them more when they're alive.
Don't we all?
Mm-hmm.
Turns out a dead whale can potentially kill us.
Oh.
In more ways than one.
So when a whale dies, it's actually generally heavier than water. So it will not just float on the surface, it will actually sink.
So far, so good. It's out of the way, right? But then a day or two later,
the whale actually appears back on the surface again.
I'm back.
This is all thanks to bacteria digesting it from the inside, farting out a heap of gas and blowing it up like a big fleshy balloon.
It's not unusual for whales, before they actually pass away, to come closer to shore to seek shelter, get out of the currents, because they just use that protection, or hope that this protection will help them a little bit, you know, calmer conditions. And of course, this is where most people are, with, you know, where most people drive the boats. And, you know, and the more whale carcasses we have, the more this can become an issue.
People die in whale boat collisions, and this is with live whales, which can presumably try to get out of the way. Imagine you're on your boat at night, just trundling along the ocean, when whoop, a big bloated fat whale just pops up in front of your bow.
The other danger, of course, is that if it washes up on the beach and it starts to, decompose, it will actually sort of get bigger and bigger, which means the guts are actually getting bigger. So there's bacteria that basically start to break down the internal nutrients that are available. And in combination with temperature, it can go quite fast. And then you have this situation where actually it's not possible to transport the whale. It would literally explode in front of everyone, which is something that you don't want.
With enough pressure, the gases should come out through an orifice, you know, the anus, maybe the mouth. But sometimes a beached whale is too far gone and bloated and falling apart to be really moved in one piece. So it needs to be sliced up. And there are videos online showing how this can go down. One video is of a sperm whale that's beached itself in the Faroe Islands. And there's this marine biologist covered head to toe in this bright orange waterproof suit. And he's cutting into the whale's belly with a blade on the end of a stick. Until blood and guts spray out of the whale and slam into the side of a nearby building.
Like, if researchers are taking whales apart that are stranded, they actually have to pay a lot of attention on how much swelling is in certain parts, and then they actually need to degas the whale first, and opening up those areas where a bubble building up, and if it's actually having signs of a lot of gassing, then it's too dangerous generally to open it up, because we're talking about 30-ton animals sometimes, and there's tons of guts inside, and they are flying around if you're opening up that animal.
An article in Wired analysed the trajectory of the flying rotten whale blood and calculated that stinky liquid shot out at around 65 kilometres an hour. The marine biologist guy was fine, by the way. Perhaps knowing what was going to happen, he positioned himself a little away from the incision. So when it did blow up, all the guts missed him. Still, there'd be some blowback, and it would stink. Fruity, fruity, fruity,
fruity, fruity, fruity. It's that fish oil smell. It's pretty dominant because a lot of that fat is omega-3 oil that comes from the krill, or the fish that the whales are eating, and that's pretty strong. But then if it gets older, you obviously get that sort of, you know, the sort of sweet rotten smell as well. But it's not, you know, it smells different to, you know, like a rotten land animal, because you always have that fishy, you know, smell in there, that omega-3 flavor.
Flavor.
But the smell is so bad because it's also sticking to you. So if you are, you know, if you're on the water or if you're on land and doing anything with the animal, like everything, all your everything that you wear, it just takes it on because of that fat. And if you have that in your hair, That's going to be fun for days. And I think you might be sleeping outside for a while.
Oh, it just sounds so rank.
I can tell you, you do not want to eat fish for a long time afterwards. The idea of sushi after you've been spending some time with a dead whale is just not, like, nope, do not want to.
But could I eat a dead rabbit that's lying on the side of the road?
Eating roadkill is the same as eating any other meat that you're able to get. You know, feral fauna is only legal fauna that you can eat in Australia. Just treat it as you would any other meat and you'll be fine.
Yep, eating roadkill. We're going there. And taking us there is retired marine ecologist and author Len Zell.
Born in central New South Wales last century in the middle.
So you describe yourself as grey nomad these days. Yes. When you go driving or travelling, do you stop for every piece of roadkill that you see?
Not anymore. I used to. Generally, yes, I will remove large roadkill from the road. Smaller stuff sometimes, depending on what it is. Sometimes I look at something and I think, what on earth are you? And want to get out and have a look and find out who they are.
One of Len's books is called Australian Wildlife, Roadkill. But that doesn't mean he's eating native animals.
As an Australian, I'm not allowed to have in my possession any native Australian fauna or part thereof without a permit. Mm-hmm. So that stops, you know, what you're able to eat.
So Len's deal is eating introduced species, you know, rabbits, blackbirds, that kind of thing. And he goes to considerable effort to make them delicious.
Fine. I want a recipe, though.
So take a blackbird, remove the guts, or what Len calls the natural stuffing, add a bit of garlic, olive oil, a dash of wine, wrap it all up in foil, pop it on the engine block and roast it till it's cooked through. It's a bit like coq au vin, really. Yum.
What the Duck in no way suggests that you should eat roadkill. This program is for education and entertainment purposes only.
But the point is that roadkill, fresh roadkill, organic, free range, no cost, never been frozen, beautiful to eat if it's cooked properly.
How do you know if that bird or bunny by the side of the road is all right to eat?
Well, it's very easy to tell with the animals freshly killed in terms of whether it's still limp, if it hasn't gone into morbidity. But also to look around the eyes and the mouth and other orifices to see if there are any flies have laid their eggs yet. That will indicate quite often that it's been there for a few hours. That doesn't matter because that won't affect the flesh. You know, a few eggs on the outside are nothing at all. But then just cook it properly, and cooking will kill any of the pathogens and parasites that may exist.
It's all in the cooking.
It's the same with any other kind of meat. If you've had a piece of meat that you've put in and out of the freezer a couple of times and thawed it and then decide to have it extra rare on the barbecue, that you got probably more chance of disease issues from that than most roadkill that's fresh.
Before making this program, if you'd asked me, Belle, what would most likely kill you? Being bitten by a dead snake, being stung by a dead jellyfish, exploded by a dead whale, or falling ill after eating a rabbit that's been hit by a car, I'd have said the last one, the rabbit. But Len says he's never been sick from eating roadkill. There are some dangers to being a roadside gourmand, though. And I'm not just talking about the risk of becoming roadkill yourself.
Another thing to watch with roadkill too, which is rather interesting, is that just be careful with your teeth. You know, if a bit of gravel's got in there, that could mess up your teeth.
I'm Belinda Smith, your What the Duck reporter for this week's episode. And I'll leave you with one more piece of advice from Len.
And always approach the animal from upwind because, you know, the flavour changes with time.
Yeah, bring a plate next time you visit, Belle. On ABC Radio National, this episode of What the Duck was made on Wurundjeri, Wadawurrung and Kaurna country. And if you liked the sound of it or the sound of some of this,
It was completely automated, of course, because, you know, you can't train a mealworm to press buttons on a spacecraft.
Is that why quolls have spots? To hide from predators or a current affair?
Its fur was glowing. And because I'd touched the mushrooms, I wondered if that was making me hallucinate.
You should not go try to milk a pigeon.
When the queen used the toilet chamber, they make a little song.
Just like, da-da-da-da.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of have that vibe.
About the only legal wildlife that we're allowed to have in Australia, of course, are ducks.
Oh, what the duck. Anyway, if you like the sound of that, follow along and subscribe on the ABC Listen app if you're in Australia. But you can also find us on Apple Podcast or a whole heap of other podcasting apps. I'll see you over there.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.